wanted to open this talk on a warm summer's day in January of 1971 on the Yarra Bank in Melbourne. And for people who don't know, the Yarra Bank for a whole period of the 20th century and a bit into the 21st century was a speaker's corner. It was effectively a place where people went every time there was a demonstration, and regularly on Sundays and some other special days, and you would get up on your soapbox and give speeches, and it was the site of much kind of radical debate and discussion. And in many occasions, that kind of debate spilled over into active physical confrontation. And on the 31st of January in 1971, the Yarra Bank was in fact the opening scene of one of the most dramatic anti-fascist demonstrations of the decade. And I'm going to be talking about that today. In August of 1970, Cass and Katrina Young, who are featured here, were two leading figures in the National Socialist Party of Australia, the NSPA, and they were part of a totally unreconstructed, swastika-loving, as you can see, Nazi organisation. And Cass and Katrina Young shifted to Melbourne because the Melbourne branch of the Nazi Party was finding it a little bit difficult in the kind of highly, left-wing city. And so they moved there in the desperate hope that they could kind of help this ailing Nazi branch, improve their fortunes. According to ASIO, when they arrived, there were somewhere between 5 and 20 active members of the branch, but the Youngs were determined to try to make it more. So they decided on a strategy of trying to hold a series of kind of public events in which they could spruik their ideas and hopefully gain more support. So in January of 1971, they decided that they would host a public event on the Yarra Banks. Now, this kind of brazen attempt at open Nazi organising was much more than many on the left could accept, and a number of Jewish organisations and student Maoists decided to organise a counter-protest. And I'll get to that here. Is just some photos of a number of other kind of confrontations that happened on the streets of Melbourne as the kind of Nazi branch attempted to establish themselves. But the police sort of became so concerned. They found out about the prospect of this anti-fascist demonstration, this fascist demonstration taking place, and they became concerned about the prospect of violence, that they convinced the Nazis, rather than coming to the Yarra Bank, to stay in their headquarters in Nicholson Street in Carlton. And they hoped that this would kind of calm the anti-fascist and left-wing protesters down. But in fact, it had the opposite effect, because the left, and the Jewish anti-fascist protesters were waiting for the Nazis to show up. They got getting more and more enraged. And in a couple of instances, they mistook, in fact, some bikies for being the Nazis who showed up. And a number of, they threw these bikies into the Yarra River. Later on, some of the anti-fascist protesters and the bikies chatted at a pub. They met one late one night, one of the people that I interviewed for my thesis, and apparently, all was kind of forgiven. But nonetheless, the protesters were just becoming more and more enraged by the situations, and over 1,000 or so anti-fascist protesters became increasingly restive. The Canberra Times reported that many of the protesters were tattooed with German concentration camp numbers, while The Australian reported that members of the crowd shouted, "They've killed my whole family. I will kill every single one of them." And you can see here, this is one of the figures, Abraham Seikiert, who was from the Jewish organisation, the Victims of Ex-Nazi Persecution. And I'll talk a little bit more about this organisation later. But he declared that the NSPA was not a political party. He said, "It is a disease, a cancer, a bubonic plague, and it should be treated in the same way." So clearly, emotions were running really high, and the crowd, according to The Age, was ripe for trouble, and they cheered and chanted. And as the realisation that the Nazis were, in fact, not arriving down at the Yarra Bank began to dawn on the anti-fascists, between 500 and 1,000 protesters left the Yarra Banks and marched up through the streets of Carlton and through the city to go to the headquarters of the NSPA, which was described in one of the newspapers of the day as a simple double-storied shop building on Nicholson Street in North Carlton, and it was here that the tensions really rose. And again, here's one of the bikies that got thrown in the river. And below you can kind of see in that picture, a number of the demonstrators showed up, dressed up in, actually some of them had kept their original concentration camp pajamas that they were forced to wear, and actually brought them along to the demonstration. So a demonstration that, you know, packed a real punch. So the Nazis had been urged by the police to stay inside the building, and so they did. But again, the crowd, kind of completely infuriated by the police presence, surged towards the Nazi building. They began hurling bottles, bricks, and insults. And the Canberra Times reported that the protesters, in their words, threw stones, drink cans, and fruit through the already broken front window of the headquarters. And one man, a former Auschwitz concentration camp prisoner, paraded outside the headquarters in the costume of a prisoner of war with his concentration camp number on his back. The Age reported that one Polish Jew, who would only give his name as Stanley, displayed a disfigured lower leg, and he said that the Germans at Buchenwald had used him for experiments. The Victoria Police, in lines of 10 strong, held their position and pushed the protesters back. And inside the house, the Nazis were armed and preparing for a shootout. Fearing an even more dramatic escalation of events, the police strong-armed the Nazis into leaving the premises, and the police backed a small, pale green van. Apparently that little detail was kind of really important for the newspapers at the time. They backed this small, pale green van into a back alley, and the Nazis tumbled wholesale, kind of, you know, desperate to kind of get out of the way. In the words of the Age, they flung themselves helter-skelter into the back of this van, and the day ended with the Nazis transported by the police to a safe house somewhere in Fitzroy. Four anti-fascist protesters had been arrested, no Nazis had been arrested, and the day ended with a very disgruntled landlord of the Nicholson Street headquarters effectively kicking the Nazis out of their headquarters there. And here's one of the images from the demonstration on the day. And I just love this image. And there's a whole bunch of faces, but in particular, I love the guy who's just kind of grinning his face off there, like just filled with the kind of joy of rebellion. And I kind of love that picture. So just to kind of take a little step back, this talk is, as Alexis said, based around some research that I've conducted for my PhD, which is on anti-fascism in Australia in the post-war period. And this research has been based primarily around archival research and interviews with activists, mainly left-wing activists from the period. And so a lot of this history is kind of barely written. And, you know, so I think it's kind of much, you know, it's really important to kind of put this research in the context as well of much of the broader kind of history and context of the period, in which there was significant mobilizations around the Vietnam War. And, you know, in lots of ways, these kind of anti-fascist confrontations were actually smaller than many of the kind of mass mobilizations that took place against Vietnam. But nonetheless, I think, you know, this kind of history is important because it kind of fills out and gives us a whole picture of what the times were like. Furthermore, for some of us who've been involved in anti-fascist mobilizations, you know, or are interested in this history, getting some sense of the kind of tactics, the dynamics of anti-fascist history in the past, all of that can matter. And I think particularly in the context of today, where people might have seen there's this government inquiry which is going on into the extremism. It's been kind of headed up by a fairly notorious right-wing liberal. And the kind of response that they're saying it's important for people to take to the far right in Australia and across the world today, extremism, is to kind of trust the security services, to trust the police, for there to be further investigations and so on and so forth. So I think having some sense of the history of radical anti-fascism in the context of that whole discussion today is particularly important. So I kind of want to move on a bit to talk about some of the main currents and communities that were involved in some of these mobilizations. And the first is of the Maoist, mainly kind of student groups. So for people who kind of don't have a sense of a little bit of the history of kind of Maoism during this period, In the 1950s and early 1960s, the Sino-Soviet split began to break apart what had been previously a very monolithic communist movement. In Australia, the Communist Party split in a few different directions, and the party which adopted the Maoist line subsequently became known as the Communist Party Marxist-Leninist. It was led by a Labor lawyer called Ted Hill, and it was a very rigid and highly authoritarian party which was really devoted to pursuing the Chinese line and defending the Chinese state, including their nuclear weapons, down the line. In the mid-1960s, in dealing with internal dissent in the ranks of the Chinese bureaucracy, Mao launched the Cultural Revolution. And what was, in fact, a very brutal internecine battle within a dictatorial regime was presented to much of the rest of the world as a radical youth rebellion against the corrupt bureaucratic order of things. And so that kind of idea of Maoism combined with the kind of substitutionist sort of moralism, all of the kind of romantic conception of Third World Revolution, which was sweeping across the world in the wake of many of the anti-colonial movements and then of Vietnam, as well as this kind of appeal of a real resolute hardness, all of that made Maoism a very appealing prospect for students across the world. And Maoism became the dominant political current on a number of campuses and in a number of cities, namely Adelaide and Melbourne. So there were two main campuses across Australia where Maoism dominated. One was Monash University. I missed the picture of the small green van. Here it is. And here is the beautiful brutalist Monash University. Here are some of the said Maoist students, and up the top, that unprepossessing figure is Ted Hill. So at Monash, the Maoists were organised into the Labour Club. And over the course of a three-year period, between 1967 and 1969, they became dominant. The club had between 90 and 120 members, and it produced a daily broadsheet called Print, which I managed to get a series of copies on from the archives, and I'll kind of run you through those in a little bit. And it had a very wide circulation, both at Monash and off the campus. And the Maoists became really well-renowned for their militant and confrontational tactics. They also began to popularise the idea of a student worker alliance, and they formed a Maoist-dominated group called, surprisingly, the Worker Student Alliance. And they produced a broadsheet called Struggle, which, I've got kind of copies of, and I'll run through those a little bit more later. But sort of as the period went on, what had seemed like mere radicalism started to morph into an ultra-left sectarianism. And this was really encouraged by Peking, whose hostility to counterculture and homosexuality didn't fit at all with the mores of Australian student life. So the Maoists were very hostile to women's liberation. They argued that it was a distraction from working class organisation, and they also rubbished any discussion of literature and art as, in their words, the products of a traitor class that was diversionary and full of filth and rubbish. Furthermore, the Maoists began a program of physical violence against other left groups and individuals, and their decline in the student movement was compounded by a real increased hostility to student demands and their turn towards a really hard Australian nationalism. And that nationalism really started to kind of isolate them amongst the radical student milieu, and by the mid-1970s, Maoist influence had well and truly waned. So now I kind of want to turn to talking a bit about the kind of second group, which was central to some of the mobilisations, and this was different elements of Melbourne's Jewish community. So for many European Jewish refugees who were living in post-war Melbourne, fascism was, to paraphrase William Faulkner, it was not dead and it was not even past. It was fascist regimes that had rounded them up. It was fascist regimes that had shaved their heads, that had starved them, that had beaten them, that had poisoned them, that had humiliated them, that had raped them, that had marched them into death camps and made them watch their children, their wives, their husbands, their brothers, their sisters, their aunts, their uncles, their friends, and their lovers die. Fascism was a social force that had broken their bones and broken their hearts. And that oppression was not just a memory. It was both structural and attitudinal in their return to many advanced Western countries. And anti-Semitism was still actually quite a prominent feature of many post-war Western countries, including Australia. So for the Jewish population of Melbourne, opposing fascism was basically a given. But that didn't mean that there was a kind of broader political unanimity amongst them. So there were divisions, for instance, between a largely Anglo-Jewish population that had lived in Australia, basically since the First Fleet. And there was a conflict between them and many of the more recently arrived Yiddish-speaking Jews from Eastern Europe. And so, for instance, you know, there was a real hostility amongst many of these Anglo establishment Jews to the admission of refugees, Jewish refugees, into Australia. And so sort of all of this combined to mean that much of the kind of Jewish anti-fascist organising was kind of left up to, in the immediate post-war period, was left up to many of the Yiddish-speaking Jews. And it was infused with quite a radical leftism. And this leftist orientation coalesced in and around the Jewish Council to Combat Fascism. And the Kadima. And this is the Kadima was actually a building in Carlton. For people in Melbourne, you might recognise it. It was actually one of the kind of hubs for much Jewish leftist and in some ways kind of Jewish secular organising in the period. And much of their organising was informed by a kind of Communist Party popular frontism. But the CPA was not the only current on the Jewish left. There was a social democratic Bundist tradition, and that competed for influence in and around the Kadima. And at times, ideological conflicts between these two forces, between the kind of Bundist forces and the Communist Party forces, actually came to blows. There was also various youth groups who competed for influence amongst both the youth and amongst the kind of broader left. And these included Hashemiyah Hatzia, Habanim, and Skif. And so for all their kind of political differences, all of these forces were nonetheless committed broadly to a kind of defiant anti-fascist tradition. But by the 1970s, a series of different groups were organising Jews in some kind of anti-fascist activity. And most were not solely devoted to anti-fascism, and some weren't actually leftist. So in terms of non-youth Jewish organisations, two in particular stand out. There was the Association of Ex-Victims of Nazi Persecution and some of the Jewish ex-servicemen. So Australian Jewish ex-servicemen, many of the kind of Australian Jews who had been served in the Second World War and had come back, they had their own organisation, separate to, for instance, the Returned Servicemen's League, which was notoriously right-wing, but they had their own traditions of mobilising against the far right. So, for instance, in January of 1960, in response to an outbreak of anti-Semitic and fascist graffiti across Melbourne, hundreds of its members attended a special meeting of members to, in their words, take appropriate action. And this involved gathering together, sending cars across the whole of Melbourne, doing big kind of their own kind of graffiti, chasing down the fascists and anti-Semites who were doing the graffiti and dealing with them. The other organisation was the Association of Ex-Victims of Nazi Persecution. And this is, there's a very limited amount of source material about this organisation, but it seems possible that this was the same group as something called the Katzletzter Fahrband, which was a mainly Yiddish-speaking organisation that also existed in the US. And it existed fundamentally to represent the interests of survivors of the Holocaust in the US and here. But according to one of the student activists that I interviewed, who was a youth member of Hashemiyah Hatzia, which was one of the kind of left-wing Jewish student groups of the day, he basically kind of made the case that these kind of older organisations were completely outside of the realm of the young people who were kind of involved in much more of the radical kind of student-based activism on the campuses. And so he kind of basically said they were too old and we were too young. So they kind of didn't really meet. And also combined with the fact that many of these older organizations actually mainly conversed in Yiddish. And so the younger people didn't. They spoke English. But Jewish students were by no means only organized into exclusively Jewish organizations. Instead, they were to be found in all the major leftist political currents of the period. So leading figures in Melbourne's Labor, Maoist, New Left and Trotskyist organisations were Jewish. So I might just turn now to the next kind of major confrontation that happened between these various kind of shifting anti-fascist forces and the Nazis headed by Cass and Katrina Young. So in 1972, in midwinter, the NFPA decided to, after their humiliating defeat of a year earlier, they hadn't given up hope, and they decided that they would organise a national conference in Melbourne. The anti-fascist activists didn't exactly know where this conference was going to be taking place, but they decided that rather than let the event kind of pass completely unmolested, they would gather in the city square in readiness to move rapidly to the venue when they discovered where it was. After a while, it became clear that they couldn't actually find out where the venue was, so they decided to head to the new headquarters of the NSPA, which was in St. Albans, in Beaver Street in St. Albans. Albert Langer, who was one of the most prominent student Maoists of the day, got on a megaphone in the city square and began to urge the hundreds of activists to go out to St. Albans to, in his words, help the Nazis move out. The Jewish protesters were actually the first to arrive and they made very short shrift of their work. Nick Butler, who was one of the student Maoists, remembered, "They arrived there before anyone else did, before the WSA did, before the police did, before the press did. By the time I arrived, the place was already destroyed." The Sydney Morning Herald offered a more lurid account of events and they said this, "They broke into the house and systematically smashed everything with boots, flagpoles, and a large hammer. At the same time, another group, including girls, smashed the windows of a car parked in the driveway and a garage and a bungalow in the backyard. Sleeping bags in the house were set on fire and literature and pamphlets bearing the swastika were strewn over the lawn." The journalist David Harcourt describes the footage from Channel 9 of the day. He said, "Several members of the crowd appeared to be hysterical. Most were shouting or screaming, and the only cry intelligible to the writer was, 'Smash the Nazi cunts.' A man in his 20s held up a swastika flag at the door of the house and shouted to those outside, 'Look at this. This is the bloody house, all right. These are the bloody Nazis. These are the people who caused the death of thousands of people in Germany and all over the world. These people should be smashed. These people should be annihilated. Death to the Nazis.' And the slogan 'Death to the Nazis' was chanted by other demonstrators for a minute or so." So you can kind of get a feel for the kind of level of heat and hostility and sort of determination to kind of, you know, just try and wipe this kind of political current out. And Nick Butler and his brother, Dale, found themselves inside the house. And Dale, who was a fitter and turner, was trying desperately to kind of douse the flames, which were starting to kind of engulf the room. And he said, he was muttering, Nick Butler kind of remembered this about his brother. He said his brother was muttering about the idiocy of burning things that could prove usable intelligence for the anti-Nazi cause. So after a search, they actually managed to get their hands on the list, the membership lists of the NSPA and the Maoist group, the Workers' Student Alliance, then published all of the kind of names in their newspaper, as you can see here. But while activists were in the process of ripping the house to pieces, a middle-aged man with a pronounced European accent got on the megaphone and spoke to the crowd. He said this, "To those I see here that survived the Nazi Holocaust by a miracle, we have a responsibility to tell the Australian people that it's not only the Jews that are endangered, but the community, and particularly for the working people." The Workers Student Alliance, which published this, they published that beforehand. sort of had a tendency to try and bring levity to every occasion. So despite the kind of seriousness with which many of the survivors of the Holocaust kind of took this demonstration, the Worker Student Alliance said this. On arrival at Mr. Young's house, the group was shocked by the conditions in which they found the house, and in a great display of generosity and goodwill, for which they are renowned, they set up a working bee. And within minutes, an amazing transformation took place. The house had been installed with natural air conditioning and heating, and all Mr. Young's paperwork cleared up. A car in the drive was given the same treatment. A carload of police, caught up in the spirit of things, came running to give assistance, but the job was finished by the time they arrived. So as Print suggested, the kind of destruction of the house was nearly complete as demonstrators left the house, walked their cars, and drove away as the first police car arrived. So you kind of get a feel for the kind of whole demonstration. So for a few months, most of the activists who had participated in the protest against the Nazi headquarters basically kind of thought nothing more of it. Most of them were heavily involved in a whole variety of other protest activities and were out basically every second night protesting against the Vietnam War, against the apartheid regime in South Africa and so on. But in the first week of December, it became clear that the state was not going to let them forget the events at Beaver Street in St. Albans. And seven leaders of the Worker Student Alliance were arrested and charged with unlawful and riotous assembly. And most of these figures were on the Central Committee of the Worker Student Alliance. And it's notable that none of the Jewish protesters were arrested, despite arguably kind of taking a larger role in the destruction of the house. And so that kind of focus by the police really, made many of the kind of, Maoist students feel like this was much more a deliberate attempt to kind of undermine their organisation and to undermine radical leftism rather than just kind of to deal with this kind of specific moment. And so the Worker Student Alliance launched a major drive to gather support for what became known as the Anti-Nazi Seven. They organised leaflet drops and glue runs. They spoke at workplace meetings and got support from trade unions. They organised a concert of over 1,000 people at Melbourne Uni to raise money, and bands played as slides which portrayed the Nazi Holocaust kind of swept by the crowd. The conflict then escalated again when on the 26th of February 1973, a 60-person strong anti-fascist guard of honour mobilised to support the anti-Nazi Seven at the Sunshine Courthouse. And this guard of honour came into conflict with a series of Nazis that were also attending to, basically condemn, the anti-Nazi protesters. And 11 more people were arrested. One of those who was arrested was a waterside worker called Harry Bouquet, which is a beautiful name for a waterside worker. And he was a very prominent member of the Communist Party Marxist-Leninist. And he had served in the Second World War and, claimed that he'd just got so overcome by seeing the kind of symbol of fascism, on these Nazis that he kind of was forced to confront them. On March the 12th, Bouquet was convicted for assaulting police and he was jailed for 2 months. So this is kind of, political jailing that, is not often talked about. And the fact that no Nazis again were charged and jailed for their part in the melee only further proved to the left and supportive sections of the union movement that this was the political proclivities of the Australian state. In May, a series of trade unions issued a leaflet campaigning in support of the anti-Nazi, rather than seven, it was now 16. And waterside workers in Melbourne actually went on strike from Thursday the 23rd of August to Monday the 27th to protest against, in their words, the re-emergence of Nazism in Australia and the jailing of one of their workmates. And by this stage, the original charges against the seven had been dropped by a prosecutorial team in doubt about the amount of evidence that they could actually kind of muster. But activists' outrage at the perceived police sympathies for the fascists were really justified because there was much photographic evidence that actually revealed police officers shaking hands with the Nazis as they were kind of protesting outside. In particular, with a figure that is actually still around today who's called the Skull, who's real name is Ross May, but he's a very prominent kind of fascist in Melbourne. And, you know, in some ways kind of seeing this footage is really remarkably similar to some of the images that occurred in Melbourne around the Reclaim Australia demonstrations, which showed, police kind of shaking hands with some of the Reclaim Australia fascists. And similarly, a dossier which was produced by ASIO on extreme violence, while considering both the far left and the far right to be of some concern, this dossier was just overwhelmingly about the far left. And I think that kind of disparity can really only be accounted for on two fronts. Firstly, that the Nazis were actually significantly smaller than the left. But, you know, secondly, that the forces which the security apparatus actually had in their sights was, again, overwhelmingly people on the left. And that kind of tacit police acceptance of the activities of the NSPA, although it kind of meant that they weren't kind of embroiled in endless court cases, it nonetheless could not save their fortunes. It didn't turn them around. They didn't manage to build a decent kind of Nazi branch in Melbourne. And by 1973, they were really a husk of an organisation. And Cass and Katrina Young eventually left the state in that year, leaving a ragged collection of individuals without any leadership. The anti-Nazi forces were absolutely jubilant and concluded that not only was direct action warranted, it could be victorious. And I think it's just worthwhile considering how justified that kind of jubilant response was, that attitude here. And really, I think I would argue that militant anti-fascist protests were important in undermining the confidence of the members of the NSPA to develop a base and to continually mobilise. The mere fact that their headquarters was ransacked twice, made it very difficult for them to find places to establish their headquarters. There was not many landlords across Melbourne who, were prepared to kind of, hand over the keys to their homes or their office space for a Nazi group to establish themselves. Furthermore, from 1971 onwards, the police actively discouraged the NSPA from making any public appearances. So they basically told them the police would no longer kind of guarantee their safety in public anymore. But I think much more generally, the 1970s, this period of the 70s, things were not shifting in the right's direction. And especially not with the kind of freshness of the Second World War. And so a far right, which really wanted to try and use all of the symbolism of the actual Nazis, of the swastikas, people who had big portraits of Hitler in their lounge rooms, that kind of Nazism didn't have much of a future ahead of it. And so there was a kind of a process of transformation which started to go on for the far right and the fascists to kind of move away from that level of explicit Nazism to something that they thought would be more palatable to a broader audience. And so the far right sort of starts to kind of drop some of that explicit stuff. And, begins to transform itself into much more of a kind of a patriotic Australian, nationalism that kind of morphed more broadly into something, sort of similar to Reclaim Australia for a period. Nevertheless, I think the whole kind of question of the establishment of a militant, anti-fascist and defiant tradition that had some orientation to developing broader links with workers, all of that is a really important legacy. For all that many anti-fascist forces belong to some quite deeply problematic political currents, this history, I think, starts to disrupt a narrative that is being peddled quite strongly at the moment, as I said before, that the best way to counter the far right, the best way to counter Nazis and fascists is to rely on the self-same security forces that in many instances are very sympathetic to the kind of politics of the far right themselves. So in this instance, it was clear for any far-right figure or organisation who cared to consider it that there was a strong and radical far-left and a small but determined anti-fascist presence that was committed to taking them on if they dared to raise their nose above the parapet. Thanks.
Plenty of time for discussion, questions, debate, and so forth. So, yeah, if people just want to pop their hands up here. Thanks for that. So I've got Vashti, who's got more or less as much time as she needs to respond to the many and varied questions and thoughts and give some thoughts of her own.
Oh, geez. Okay, well, where to start? Yeah, I mean, on the question about the student movement and the radicalism of the time, I mean, there was a whole series of things that contributed to the particularities of the student radicalism in the 70s. So the fact that some of the campuses like Monash was relatively new, you know, there were tens and tens of thousands of, you know, formerly working class, you know, young people who are kind of sweeping into the institutions. You know, there was a kind of global youth revolt, which contributed to that sense of a new kind of radical identity. There were a whole series of anti-colonial movements, which, as I said in the talk, had kind of come to victory, which were inspiring people, you know. So I think, you know, there are particularities, but there is also the fact that when there are more radical kind of moments start to open up, university campuses have, in every decade of at least the 20th century and certainly even kind of back into the, you know, 17th and 18th kind of, well, maybe the 19th century at the very least, the 17 and 1800s, university campuses have kind of been sites of radicalism and rebellion. And partly, you know, I think it's, you know, there can be kind of sociological explanations for that, but it is also a kind of gathering together of, to some degree, kind of young people in the one place where it's possible for them to kind of be debating out ideas. And for all that in the modern university, lots of people are just, you know, here kind of time serving, you know, do your classes, get off and whatever. I think when things start to change, university campuses can be sites, and, you know, across the world today, you know, if you look at any of the rebellions that are happening from Hong Kong to Myanmar, the universities are actually key battlegrounds. So I don't think we can kind of discount students just left yet as kind of, and universities as sites of rebellion. People are right, I think, to emphasise the kind of broader context of the left. And I think when you're kind of discussing any tactics for any protest movement or mobilisation, it's impossible to talk about them outside of the context in which they're occurring. So I think it's very difficult to kind of, you know, say, you know, oh, just in the abstract is kind of smashing up a Nazi house, you know, forever and always ultra left or forever and always the right thing to do. Clearly in this period, there was a whole range of kind of much more direct confrontational activities and protests and things that were going on. You know, in terms of analysing this in this particular moment, these activities, I would say there were kind of the fact that the Jewish population was leading these kind of demonstrations in many ways means that you kind of can't say that it was ultra-left in the same way. It wasn't, you know, just informed by the kind of, you know, thought-through tactics of the Maoists, which were undeniably ultra-left in every instance, pretty much. you know, but the Maoists were kind of generally ultra-left and, you know, did sort of have this attitude of, you know, violence is the kind of way to radicalize people involved in things. So they had this kind of theory of like, you hit someone over the head, that, you know, is better than reading 10 books about revolution. Like, you know, you kind of, you get attacked by the cops, you'll learn more about the world than you would if you kind of sat down and read a library. Well, you know, like that attitude was sort of on display in these protests as well. And Tom sort of asked about the Trotskyists and the some of the other political currents. Like, the Trotskyists in Melbourne in the period were very small and were really in a process of trying to clarify and consolidate their ideas. And so I interviewed a number of the Trotskyists out at Monash, you know, some of whom were actually Jewish as well. All of them, actually, the people that I interviewed. And their kind of attitude was they went along to the demonstrations, but they were too small to kind of have, and they didn't have an organisation to kind of make a decision about, is this something we want our organisation to participate in? And they also were much more focused in the arguments of Dave Nadel, who was one of the kind of leading student radicals out at Monash during the period, who was also became a kind of Trotskyist in this period. His kind of argument was we were much more focused on the kind of two things. Number one, the Vietnam War. Number two, kind of political debate and clarification about what sort of socialists we were and are. His argument was the kind of the bigger threat in terms of the far right, according to him at least, was not the kind of NSPA, was not these kind of, you know, uniform wearing Nazis, but was groups like the Ustasha, which was an Eastern European fascist organization, and then some sections of the kind of DLP, which was the kind of far-right Democratic Labour Party, which is a whole other story, which I won't have time to go into. So, yeah, I mean, I think the kind of the broader thing here is that, all of these kind of complexities are really, I think, important to kind of acknowledge. But on the other hand, I do think, the excavating some of this history of kind of rebellious anti-fascism, not a state-based anti-fascism, is still an important and urgent task.